Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
I should clarify, however, that the focus of what I'll be talking about in terms of discretion is on a very discreet phase, which is the phase one process, so not to disappoint.
Sounds good.
Oh, thank you. At the outset, I'd like to thank the co-organizers, including for the opportunity to speak today. Although I work in the Office of the Prosecutor as a situation analyst and therefore will be drawing upon my experience in SAS, I have to clarify that indeed I'm speaking in my personal capacity today, and views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of the OTP. Building on some of the issues that my colleague Mathilde just spoke about, today I would like to focus on quality control relating to one specific aspect of preliminary examinations, namely the selection of situations for preliminary examination, or what we refer to as the phase one process, which is essentially a pre-preliminary examination stage. While it doesn't consistently receive a lot of scrutiny or attention as in comparison to other phases, phase one is nonetheless a crucial component of the work of the OTP, being an integral part of the prosecutor's unique role in selecting situations for intervention by the court. While pursuant to policy, state and security council referrals, as well as Article 12.3 declarations, automatically trigger the opening of a preliminary examination, Article 15 communications, such as those submitted by individuals or groups alleging the commission of crimes, do not necessarily lead to the initiation of a preliminary examination, or PE. Instead, these communications are first subject to an initial filtering process to assess whether the allegations received appear to fall within the court's jurisdiction and therefore justify the opening of a preliminary examination. Notably in this regard, faced with the numerous alleged atrocities around the world purportedly deserving the court's attention, the OTP must efficiently and effectively filter hundreds of communications every year to decide when and where to intervene. This process in part influences the type of situations and crimes that will be prioritized by the Office of the Prosecutor, thereby potentially shaping how the office carries out its mandate in years to come. However, notably, the ICC statute doesn't envisage any mechanism of quality assessment over decisions taken at this phase one stage. It could be suggested that maybe this is less than ideal, given the fact that such decisions, even at this inceptual stage, nevertheless can have implications for the trajectory of the court's work, as well as for public perception of the court's legitimacy and credibility. However, if we look at the activities that are actually undertaken at the phase one stage, we can identify certain mechanisms aimed at ensuring forms of quality control, such as the implementation of a two-step internal filtering and assessment process, the enhancement of transparency in such process, and finally also the manner in which the discretion of the prosecutor is exercised during this process. So, what does phase one entail, and how do quality control considerations factor into this process and assessment? So, as you can imagine, every year the office receives several hundred Article 15 communications. For example, in 2016, we received nearly 600 communications, that is, communications asking the court to intervene in a given situation. Article 15 communications come in different forms and contain widely varying levels of detail. They can range from a couple-line email to a large submission with voluminous supporting materials. But in all cases, these communications are subjected to the same process and assessment by the office. Essentially, the first step is that communications received are first filtered according to whether the allegations, one, manifestly fall outside the court's jurisdiction in terms of temporal jurisdiction, personal territorial, or very like prima facie subject matter jurisdiction. If they do, then they're accordingly dismissed. Otherwise, we look at whether instead the allegations are linked to an ongoing preliminary examination situation or a situation that's under investigation, in which case those communications and any information they're providing would be forwarded on to the team within the office who's working on that situation or case. And finally, the most interesting category of all is whether instead the matters referred to in the communication are neither manifestly outside of the jurisdiction of the court nor related to an existing situation, and therefore, as we call it, warrant further analysis. So this filtering process in general, this first step, it's subject to several layers of internal review, including final approval ultimately by the prosecutor herself. So the next step is turns on the issue of these communications which warrant further analysis, or as we like to call them, or the office likes to call them, WFA communications, which is a term I'm going to be using. So these WFA communications are then subjected to a second filtering process, which goes way beyond, or substantially beyond in most cases, just a basic screening. And I think in the phase one process, most people associate it with it's a basic filtering. And it's true, that's one aspect of it. But another important aspect is how we analyze these WFA communications. So this analysis includes a more in-depth factual and legal assessment, as well as the preparation of what we call a phase one report. The purpose of such analysis is to assess the allegations in order to assist the prosecutor and the rest of the executive committee in reaching a decision on whether or not the alleged crimes appear to fall within the jurisdiction of the court and therefore warrant moving on to phase two, the formal commencement of a PE. Since mid-2012, SAS has produced nearly 40 phase one reports relating to WFA communications. While the majority indeed were dismissed, as a result of such analysis, the office did open two preliminary examinations on such basis since 2012, namely the situation with UK forces in Iraq, the reopening, and then as well as more recently the situation in Burundi. At present, the office is also notably focusing on a number of WFA communications involving complex allegations, such as those concerning alleged forcible evictions in Cambodia, Australia's alleged deportation and ill treatment of asylum seekers, and alleged extrajudicial killings in the Philippines in connection with the so-called war on drugs. So those are still pending analysis. As my time is limited today, I'd like to just highlight a few main points regarding how we analyze these WFA communications in the process. It's quite intricate, actually, but my time is quite limited. So, first, something that's important to point out is that the evidentiary standard used at the phase one stage is whether the crimes appear to fall within the jurisdiction of the court. So as opposed to the higher standard used at preliminary examinations, which is reasonable basis to believe. The lower standard avoids duplication efforts with prospective future analysis, such as, for example, if it moves to phase two, but at the same time, importantly ensures that a decision to move forward is not made prematurely without a sufficient legal and factual basis. This is particularly important given the need to carefully select situations to make certain that the office's time and limited resources are devoted to situations which appear to involve the most serious crimes of concern to the international community and those which also offer potentially realistic prospects for ICC intervention. Next, regarding the scope and the nature of the analysis conducted by the office, in general, phase one analysis of WFA communications involves two steps, which is also very similar to how we do phase two, but at a much lower level in terms of depth. So one, a factual analysis in consultation with reliable and open sources to corroborate allegations. Secondly, legal analysis of the substantiated allegations in accordance with the relevant provisions of the statute. Regarding the analysis, just a few points. Notably, something we often get questions about is that the specific allegations contained in a given communication are not considered in isolation, but instead are considered in conjunction with other related communications, as well as relevant open source information. In this regard, communications often are viewed by the office simply as a means to direct its attention to a situation of concern, which is then independently and objectively assessed by the office. It's further worth mentioning that to a limited extent, prosecutorial discretion may also play a role in the analysis of and conclusions on WFA communications. In particular, in the context of the phase one analysis, the office may occasionally encounter situations which, due to a variety of factors, the alleged crimes, while not manifestly outside of the jurisdiction, do not necessarily clearly appear to fall within the subject matter jurisdiction. Or another, what you could think of is a borderline situation. In such situations, the office has recently explained, namely last year in the PE report, annual PE report, that in determining whether or not to open a preliminary examination, the office will take into account additional factors, including those related to policy and those relevant to a forward-looking assessment of the exercise of the court's jurisdiction. In particular, in this regard, the office will first consider whether the lack of clarity with respect to whether the crimes appear to fall within the court's jurisdiction applies to most or only a limited set of the allegations, and in case of the latter, whether they are nevertheless of such gravity to justify further analysis or moving forward. Additionally, the office will consider whether the court's jurisdiction may be restricted due to factors such as a narrow geographic and or personal scope of jurisdiction. For example, you can see that in the ISIS situation, and or the existence of national proceedings related to the relevant conduct. In this regard, although we would take into account in such a limited situation, national proceedings, that's not to say that we actually assess complementarity at phase one stage. Instead, the phase one stage primarily focuses on jurisdictional requirements. The office has further indicated, notably, that it will take into account its prosecutorial strategy of focusing on those most responsible for the most serious crimes under the court's jurisdiction, and as a general rule, will follow a so-called conservative approach in terms of deciding whether or not to open a preliminary examination. This sort of conservative approach and accordingly selectivity in the identification of situations for preliminary examinations is arguably necessary and legitimate given the unique mandate of the court as well as its capacity constraints. So, having provided a very, very quick overview of the office's phase one practices methodology, I'd finally like to briefly address how issues of quality control can come into play at the phase one stage. Notably, the statute doesn't provide for any explicit external control over the OTP's assessment of Article 15 communications. There's no mechanism, for example, allowing judicial review of the prosecution's decisions and reasoning in this regard. For example, this was seen in the attempted, the purported 12-3 declaration filed on behalf of former Egyptian President Morsi after the Office of the Prosecutor announced that we would not be opening a preliminary examination. This was challenged. Ultimately, the chamber came back and said that, in fact, at this stage, there's no room for a review. Accordingly, given these circumstances, to a certain extent, the maintenance of a certain standard in terms of quality, legal reasoning, and coherence in terms of decision taken, thus falls primarily on the office. To this effect, the office has implemented an organized, consistent process for filtering and assessing allegations received under Article 15, involving substantiating the allegations with reliable open sources, conducting analysis in accordance with the relevant statutory provisions and jurisprudence, and subjecting analysis and conclusions to different levels of internal review within the office. In addition, notably, during this process, the office frequently does engage directly with communications senders and, where appropriate, other relevant actors, usually on a confidential basis. Such engagement includes, for example, in-person meetings, and in some cases followed by the office to seek clarifications or additional information from communication senders. Notably, senders of dismissed communications can seek to convince the prosecutor to reconsider his or her decision by submitting additional information. This is something that's noted in all letters that are sent to communication senders explaining that they have this avenue, and indeed it is something that senders often do. Overall, such direct exchanges improves the quality of the analysis of the office, allowing senders and relevant stakeholders to provide input which may better form or assist the office's analytical and decision-making process at the phase one stage. Further, such engagement gives such communication senders and other relevant affected actors the possibility to be heard even at this early stage and to better understand the office's views. Notably, also, the office engages in a number of other activities in order to enhance transparency, which also potentially thus provide also a means towards further quality control. In this respect, it is recognized that the office indeed does not publicize or report its phase one activities to the same extent as it does in relation to activities undertaken with respect to situations that are actually under preliminary examination. However, such an approach stems in large part from the office's obligation to protect the confidentiality of information received under Article 15 of the statute. Nevertheless, with respect to decisions taken at the phase one stage, the office doesn't operate from the shadows. Most importantly in this regard, the office does convey its decisions directly and the reasons for them directly to the senders of the communications to explain the outcome and why. In terms of public reporting, the office makes public announcements when preliminary examinations are opened, and in a limited number of cases, has also issued public statements explaining decisions not to open a preliminary examination. This was shown, for example, in the case of the situation concerning ISIS, when the prosecutor made a statement to clarify and explain why the Office of the Prosecutor at this stage would not be opening such a preliminary examination. Further, I think the office's efforts in the last several years to explain the filtering process, such as that which was done in the policy paper, and more recently, to clearly outline the policy considerations that the office may consider in so-called borderline situations, can be seen as an attempt to shape the prosecution's discretion in a clear and a transparent manner, as to promote greater understanding of and predictability in the office's selection of situations for preliminary examinations. So, nevertheless, there is room for improvement in terms of enhanced transparency in the selection of situations for preliminary examination, and as well in the explanation of the reasons underlying those decisions. So, cognizant of this, more recently, the office, for example, has decided to provide a more detailed response to senders of WFA communications, further outlining the reasons underlying the decisions, a new approach which will be implemented in the course of this year. This approach aims not only increasing communication center understanding of the criteria guiding the OTP's decision-making process and the basis for the conclusion reached, but also for reinforcing the perceived credibility and seriousness of the office's actions and deliberation process. Further, in cases where WFA communications are dismissed, by giving more clarity and specificity regarding the reasons for the dismissal, senders are more enabled to understand the particular issues on which they can provide additional information in, for example, any future communications. Additionally, by clearly outlining the legal basis for the decision, the office can potentially counter speculation or allegations that a decision was taken with respect to a given situation was motivated by political or other non-legal factors. I think I will wrap up here so that we have plenty of time for questions. Yes, perfect. So thanks so much for your attention.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.